Hey, sit down listeners. You can find us every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Teens use Instagram to explore and connect. That's why we build features that can help teens see less sensitive content, interact in positive ways, and spend time on Instagram intentionally, and tools that help parents support them in building a safe Instagram experience. Because we're committed to building a community where everyone feels supported. Explore more than 30 tools that can help teens have a positive experience on Instagram at instagram.com/safety.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great week wherever you are. This is episode 61, and we are back and better than ever. Another week, another show, another sit down, and we have an absolutely gigantic show planned for you today. I've kind of been talking this one up. We've put this one off for a week or two because I wanted to make sure I brought you the best information, the best research, and the best story possible. On this show, for the most part, we talk about the Italian mafia. However, this show is about organized crime. And on occasion, we've talked about Black organized crime and Asian organized crime. We've even talked about the police. But today, we're going to get back into that. We're going to talk about, in my opinion, and really in anyone's opinion that studied it, we're going to talk about one of the most corrupt police investigative units in the history of America. And if you've watched recently the critically acclaimed TV show, We Own This City, you know a little bit about this story. Today, we're going to talk about an individual, a sergeant in the Baltimore Police Department called Wayne Jenkins. And we're going to talk about his dirty crew of corrupt cops called the Gun Trace Task Force. Now, the Gun Trace Task Force, we're really going to talk about everything involved with this case. We're going to get into really kind of patterning the show around Wayne Jenkins. We're going to tell you about where he comes from, you know, when he got into the department, the guy that he was, the officer that he was. We're going to talk about the longstanding tradition of really corruptness in the corruptness and the corruption that goes on in the Baltimore Police Department. We're going to talk about how for years, you know, people have trained other people to become corrupt and dirty. We're going to talk about how the Gun Trace Task Force was created, what its purpose was, how ultimately all eight individuals involved with it became associated with crime, the crimes they committed, how they were ultimately caught, and where they are now. It's going to be a long-standing story, and I hope you enjoy the show. I really look forward to doing it, and I truly feel this may be and will be one of the best shows we've done. As always, before we get into the show, I want to thank you for listening. Make sure, if you're just checking out the show for the first time, make sure you subscribe, whatever platform you're on. Please leave me a detailed review. Give me 5 stars if you think I deserve it. That's all I ask. Also, if you enjoy the show and you haven't done it, make sure you go give us a follow on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. If you also enjoy our mafia content here and you want more of it, I urge you, go check us out on YouTube as well. We continue to gain subscribers each day and put out quality content on smaller individuals that maybe we don't have an hour for. So make sure you go check us out. Just search the Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Without further ado, folks, let's get into it. We're going to go straight through Wayne Jenkins and the Gun Trace Task Force next on the sit down. Wayne Jenkins was born in 1980. He would actually grow up in Middle River, which is a suburb in Baltimore County, just to the northeast of Baltimore City. Now, Wayne Jenkins was the youngest of five kids, and he actually will graduate from Eastern Technical High School. He was someone that, interestingly enough, during his childhood, many people would lament and talk about the kind of kid that Wayne Jenkins was. And he was always a nice kid, but he was one that didn't take shit from anybody. He was never going to be bullied, and he was going to always kind of, in the end, kind of get what he wanted. Upon his graduation from high school, Wayne Jenkins would actually join the military. He would join the Marine Corps. And at one point, he would be discharged. And in 2003, at 23, he would join the Baltimore Police Department. That would happen on February 20th, 2003. Now, he would kind of jump off real quick. He would be put in the Eastern District. If you know anything about the Eastern and in Baltimore, the Eastern is a tough neighborhood. You know, you have neighborhoods there that, you know, really difficult. You look at places like Patterson Park. You look at places like, Middle East, you know, really tough neighborhoods that really are places that are tough to go. And for Wayne Jenkins, he would quickly learn that around those times in Baltimore, you need to have eyes in the back of your head, but you needed to do what you had to do to survive. Like the men in the streets, Wayne Jenkins needed to do what he had to do to be an effective cop. Now, I kind of want to talk about the early to mid 2000s and what Baltimore looked like as a whole. At that time, the individual that was in charge of Baltimore was a guy called Martin O'Malley. He was preceded by a guy called Kurt Schmoke, and he would be introduced as mayor in 1999. He'd remain mayor for 8 years. One of the things that Marty O'Malley was known to do was he had a hard focused, kind of aim on reducing the very high murder rate. And he had one of those zero tolerance policies, stop and frisk, jump out boys. He was very much in the camp of, if we get people off the street, if they're not on the street, they can't shoot each other. So basically he said to himself, all right, here's what we're going to do. Every day, we're going to try to make more arrests than we did the day before. The problem was, yes, they were getting people off the street, but again, they weren't keeping them. They were doing things like arresting you for open container, taking you down to Eager Street, which is the jail. You would sign something, they'd keep you there for 6 or 8 hours, and then they'd release you the next day and do it all over again. Now, the problem that O'Malley had was the murder rate really didn't drop in any way. You know, you look at during Martin O'Malley's time as mayor, we look at let's just look at the homicides, for instance, homicides per year. In 2000, it was 261, 2001, 256. The lowest point in Martin O'Malley's career was in 2002. Homicide rate was 253 murders. Then it went up to 270 in 2003, 276 in 2004. And it really kind of stayed within 270 to 280 or so. And that was the problem for Martin O'Malley. This strategy did not work. There was one year where it had a little success, but you look at the arrest rate, it was up significantly higher. And Wayne Jenkins was kind of making his bones as a cop in this type of environment. The goal was do what you had to do to bring people in. Now, people were bringing people in the wrong way, and people were doing things they shouldn't. And ultimately, no one really cared because they were bringing in arrests. And that was the story of Wayne Jenkins' career. And I want to go back quickly to a part of Wayne Jenkins' career that we look back and kind of say, okay, maybe this is where everything started. During Wayne Jenkins' early career, he would actually be in a area of East Baltimore called McKeldry Park. And during that time, he was with an individual that was schooling him on how to be a cop and all that sort of thing. He had only been a police officer for like 2 years at that point. He was working in plain clothes, a flex unit. When he and the individual he's working with come upon two individuals that are on a stoop, him and this guy called Fries. That was his partner at the time. They noticed these guys drinking Steel Reserve on the sidewalk. No one had called a complaint. They just happened to hassle these two. Jenkins and Fries tell the men to go inside. They don't go inside. They circle back, and the two guys are still outside. Jenkins got out of the car and said he tried to be nice, but now they were going to jail. When one of the men darted into the home, Jenkins rushed in, and they spilled out of the house and onto the sidewalk, struggling. All this happened over nothing, said one of the brothers, Charles Lee. Police officers came over because they had nothing better to do. Backup is then called by Wayne Jenkins. He would spot a man, George Sneed, across the street. He'd also arrest him. Jenkins would yell at the responding officers. They would then, in sworn deposition, say that Sneed had been yelling expletives about police and throwing glass bottles at them. The bottles were winged at us. I mean, it had a velocity, Jenkins said. Sneed then chased and caught, and his jaw was broken in the process. They ordered us to fuck them up. We fucked them up, one of the responding officers, Robert Cirillo, now retired, said in an interview with The Sun. So again, this is just 2 years after becoming a police officer. Wayne Jenkins is already, this is where things start. Now, again, this was regular behavior in the Baltimore Police Department. This is something that they would say, this is where we made our bones. And this was normal behavior. But again, very early, Wayne Jenkins was taught by people above him to lie, to connive, and to say whatever you had to say to do what he had to do. In 2006, the guy Fries, Jenkins' partner, would actually promote him to high-profile plainclothes called organized crime. So Wayne Jenkins was quickly rising. And in a city that was known for arrests, in 2005 alone, Wayne Jenkins made 400-plus arrests himself. And that's a lot of arrests. That's, you know, over an arrest a day. You don't work every day. You're making two-plus arrests a day. That is good work for a cop. Now, again, we have to ask ourselves, were all those things done at the right level? And by 2006, all the arrests that are happening, complaints start coming in on Wayne Jenkins. And by 2007, though, it didn't matter. He continues to be promoted. And a lot of people thought about Wayne Jenkins. The simple thought was, well, yeah, he's raw. He is full of complaints. But in the end, this is a tough city to police in. And he's effective at the end of the day. And no one really cared, ultimately. Now, the next insular goal of the city at this point in the mid-2000s, so let's say 2007, 2008, we look at, you know, kind of where we are, the murder rate is still significantly high. Now, O'Malley is kind of on his way out. He goes out in January of 2017. A woman, Sheila Dixon, takes over. Now, they would create in Baltimore City a group in 2007 called the Gun Trace Task Force. Now, the Gun Trace Task Force, the initial purpose of the task force was to take high target individuals that are trafficking guns into the streets and seize as many as possible. Because again, the more guns you were seizing, the less opportunities you had for shootings. Now, along with that, you would do warrants, you would do car stops, you would seize drugs. They were really a high-end unit. And if you look at any police department, they have these different units, whether it's a gun unit, whether it's a drug seizure unit, whether it's a drug enforcement, whether it's an organized crime, whether it's a sex crime, whether it's a whatever. There are all these different specialized units. Now, initially with the Baltimore Gun Trace Task Force, you look at in 2007, actually was pretty effective. They seized 268 guns themselves. And that was according to a terrific book called We Own This City by Justin Fenton, a former Baltimore police reporter. So they actually were really quite successful. In fact, you look at in 2007, the police department as a whole did a terrific job. Problem was, there were still 282 murders. So none of this stuff had a particularly good success rate. But again, the people that were involved in this unit, like Wayne Jenkins, were having some success. And the thought around the department was, people knew who Wayne Jenkins was. And to keep in mind, he had only been 4 years into the department. He was already very well known inside the department. The problem was for him, he was thriving, but he was becoming very arrogant. He also, in 2009, had kind of his biggest success yet. We all know, if you know anything about the police, you know anything about high brass police, they love dope on the table, right? They love the photo op where they can put the heroin or the coke, the big bundles and all the cash and the jewelry and the phones and everything you have. They love the seizures. In 2009, Wayne Jenkins would seize approximately 41 kilos of cocaine worth an estimated street value of about $3 million. At that point, one of his counterparts would say, Wayne Jenkins is the messiah of drugs. Another officer wasn't so keen on Jenkins. He would say, it just didn't seem possible. How could he be that effective by the book? So again, the thought is maybe we should oversee what Wayne Jenkins is doing. But you know what? We're not going to do that because we don't really care. As long as Wayne Jenkins is bringing in arrests, as long as Wayne Jenkins is bringing in dope on the table, we don't care who the hell he bothers or hurts. Wayne Jenkins in his personal life was also having some success. He would marry his longtime partner, Christy Jenkins, and they would have multiple children. Now, he also was starting to have some success fighting in MMA. Wayne Jenkins would fight on a local circuit MMA tour, compiling a 7-0 record. He would be called Silverback. He was frequented. People knew who this guy was, and they didn't want to fuck with him. At one point, a higher up attorney general and assistant U.S. attorney would say, Wayne Jenkins is the most effective gun cop this city has ever seen. So there you go. Things are going good for Wayne Jenkins. I want to kind of start talking a little bit about this this problem for not even for Baltimore, but for in general where we're going to go. So what we're going to do is we're kind of at the point with Wayne Jenkins where things start to happen in the Gun Trace Task Force. And we're going to go over a certain amount of names and we're going to go through their stories. I feel like things are going great with this so far. I want to get into 2010, April of 2010, to be exact. This is where the first real questionable behavior from Wayne Jenkins starts. And it has a lot to do with kind of, again, the fact of Wayne Jenkins and how these guys would do things. Okay, a lot of their arrests had to do with when you were in the Gun Trace Task Force, you were doing a lot of warrant kind of investigative work, but you were also doing car stops and you were taking guns off people. And what Wayne Jenkins would do was he had a very simple thing. He would sit outside gas stations. And when you leave, let's say a gas station or a restaurant, you may not immediately put on your seatbelt, right? You get going. And then as you're driving, you put the seatbelt on. What Wayne Jenkins was notorious for is he would sit outside of a gas station and he would pull people over for not wearing seatbelts. Okay. That was his thing. In 2010, he would be in North Baltimore in a kind of a residential neighborhood. He was sitting on a car that he assumed was taking part in the drug transaction. There was two individuals in a car. One walks out of a house to a car with a backpack. Jenkins, according to most people that work with him, they knew he had a keen eye for understanding people that were making drug transactions. He spots an individual called Brett Matthews and a driver, Umar Burley, in a car. Okay, they're in the area of Gwin Oak Avenue and Bell Avenue up in North Baltimore. He's alongside officers Ryan Gwynn and Sean Suter. He decides, all right, we're going to go in this car. They go at this car. Burley assumes, now keep in mind, they had no lights on their car. They didn't identify themselves as police, and they had a ski mask on. Burley assumes these individuals are trying to rob him. He guns it in his car. A chase ensues. They're flying through residential Baltimore at high rates of speed. Ultimately, Umar Burley buries another car and crashes out. The individual that was in the other car was an 86-year-old man and an 80s-old woman as well. This is the issue for Wayne Jenkins. He had no probable cause to chase after the suspect. The suspect according to his knowledge, had no drugs, had no guns. He did not identify himself as police. In the department, there's a strict rule that you don't do this sort of thing. So Wayne Jenkins realizes, okay, I gotta fix this somehow. There's no drugs in this car. I know that. He has Officer Sean Suter search the car multiple times. They come up with nothing. The also issue that Umar Burley has is the individual, Albert Davis, who was in the other car, is dead. Okay, so now there's really a problem, not only for Burley, but for most, for Wayne Jenkins, who initiated this. After a third and final search, Wayne Jenkins all of a sudden tells Sean Suter to, quote, go check out that car one more time. At that point, Sean Suter, under the passenger seat, would all of a sudden find 32 grams of heroin. At that point, Burley and Matthews are taken in to prison. Now, it was pretty clear, as I tell you this story, that it was widely likely that Wayne Jenkins planted the drugs. Now, for Umar Burley, he would ultimately be found guilty of this crime with drugs and manslaughter for killing Mr. Davis and get 25 years in federal prison. The opponent that he had with him, Brett Matthews, would also get a prison sentence. Now, as many people know, and we're going to confirm this later, ultimately this case was vacated. Mr. Burley was released after 8 years. Mr. Matthews was released after 3 years. Both of them would sue the city of Baltimore, and Mr. Burley would make away with just over $6 million. So this is the first, you have to scratch your head at the way Wayne Jenkins is doing things. Now, this is something that really wasn't that surprising, though, because by this point, Wayne Jenkins had multiple complaints against him. There were multiple things lodged that, you know, he was screwing around with citizens. He was doing things to citizens. And while he was a cowboy, again, it didn't matter because he was bringing in arrests. In 2010, Deputy Commissioner Anthony Barksdale also wanted a special squad to go after elusive suspects. He would pick Jenkins to be a part of that group. Later that year, the mayor would hold a news conference for another one at Jenkins' bus. He and an officer had raided a car wash, recovering more than a kilogram of drugs and $4,000 from hidden desk compartments, what could be only used using magnets within a fish tank. So again, didn't really matter that there were multiple complaints lodged against him. Didn't matter. He was bringing in and doing things. Now, in 2012, Jenkins will be promoted to sergeant. And this is where he hastily begins his descent into becoming a dirty cop. He, alongside certain members of the Gun Trace Task Force, are starting to be dirty. Now, the real dirty crimes start to happen around 2014. And I want to talk about first the sergeant at the time. The leader of this group and the person that oversaw and was the officer in charge was an individual called Thomas Allers. In 2013, Thomas Allers would take over officer in charge duties of the Gun Trace Task Force. Now, he originally became an officer back in 1996, and he would take over the control of this unit. His top guy under him was Wayne Jenkins. Now, one thing that was, according to the Gun Trace Task Force, a normal thing that police officers did, these officers had a lot of major crimes they were involved in. We're going to get into them. But one of the major crimes all of these officers had was the fact that they were not only stealing overtime, but they were falsifying overtime documents, run sheets, and basically mentioning that they were working when they were not working. For instance, in one indication, Wayne Jenkins was actually on vacation in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, but for that 7 days he was off, every day he would put in that he actually worked those days. Now, this is probably, in all the crimes that the GTTF committed, this was probably the most non-lethal. But again, these were the things that kind of started all that. I want to go to March 2014. By this point, Sergeant Allers is in control, and he's alongside two other defendants in this case, an individual, Mamadou Gando and Jamel Rayum. They are both part of the GTTF. They are executing a search warrant at a residence in Baltimore County. The individual that owned the house was nicknamed GW by the feds. Now, GW had approximately $420,000 in the residence at the time of the search. His wife had approximately $2,000 in the house. Now, these individuals had a search warrant, went in the house. Now, they went in just those three and waited for local Baltimore County law enforcement to show up. They would disperse to a drawer full of money in the upstairs bedroom. The money was bundled in multiple sacks. Allers would tell Mama Dugando and Jamel Ram, quote, "The homeowner won't miss just a stack," or words to that effect. Allers would then take the cash from the drawer. He would each give Jamel Ram and Mama Dugando approximately $8,000 to $10,000. Allers, who also had his adult son with him, who again was not a police officer, he was just there for the take, he also took some of the cash. When the Baltimore County law enforcement arrived, they seized the remaining cash from the residence, which approximated to about $350,000. Now, remember, originally, GW claimed there was $416,000 in the house. So Thomas Allers, Mama Dugando, Jamel Ram, and the son made off with about $66,000. Now, we think about it like this. Let's just say Ram and Gondo both got $10,000. That's $20,000. Let's say the son got $5,000. That's $25,000. Mr. Allers walked away with, what can we say, maybe $40,000? Now, again, this goes through a long stretch of times they did this. Another situation, October 8th of 2014, they would enter a store in Baltimore City to execute a search warrant. They would find approximately $9,000 in cash above the store in an apartment. Allers would steal $3,000. The remaining $6,000 was recovered by the U.S. Marshal Service. Now, you're probably listening to this and saying to yourself, okay, now this is normal. A lot of cops probably do this. Yeah, but again, this is a part of a superseding problem that these officers are engaging in. Now, again, these aren't just officers doing this. These are officers with their supervisor doing this, okay? So this is a major problem. Now, around this time as well, another member of the team, Wayne Jenkins, is also beginning to pull people over. Let's say he grabs drugs off them. Wayne Jenkins is now starting to take the drugs and sell them to an individual that he knew. Wayne Jenkins was connected to a guy called Donald Stepp. Now, Donald Stepp was not a police officer. Donald Stepp was a drug trafficker at one point, fixes his life, gets into the mortgage business, then decides he wants to be a bail bondsman. He creates a company called Double D's Bail Bonds, which is a company that was based in Baltimore County and in Baltimore City, where he did his business. At one point, Wayne Jenkins becomes very close with Stepp. Stepp had knew Jenkins' brothers at one point. He was a little older than Jenkins. Him and Stepp regularly hang out. They play poker, go to casinos, things of that nature. One night, Jenkins and Stepp are on their way back from a casino in Delaware. Jenkins poses the idea to Stepp that, hey, obviously we know you used to sell drugs. It is what it is. If I got you some work, could you get rid of it? Stepp agrees. They start selling heroin. Now, remember, he is a sworn police officer selling drugs to a known drug dealer. Okay, so this is a continued overt act and all comes into one indictment. So now, okay, we've checked off two boxes. You have a task force that's goal is to take guns off the street. That A is pulling people over without any probable cause, going in homes without warrants, stealing money from seizures, stealing drugs, then selling the drugs back, planning drugs on individuals. This is just the tip of the iceberg, okay? And I want to go into some other things here. I want to talk about kind of how people start getting involved here. In 2015, Thomas Allers would actually, who was a sergeant at the time, he would actually start doing some work with the federal government. So Jenkins becomes the officer in charge of this unit. Now, all of a sudden, four more officers get involved. Maurice Ward, Marcus Taylor, Avodio Hendricks, and Daniel Herschel. Now, Herschel is someone that is very well known, not only to the brass of Baltimore, but the public. Herschel is what we would call a problem cop. And by this point, Daniel Herschel has had almost 50 complaints against him. Now, none were being sustained. And what I mean by sustained was none were actually checking out. They were being thrown out or nobody was doing anything about it. Herschel was a problem cop. But again, in the eyes of the brass, they knew who Daniel Herschel was, but they were, again, willing to forgive who he was because he was making arrests. That's all they cared about. Daniel Herschel, yeah, he was a problem cop. Didn't matter, though. He made arrests. And I want to talk quickly about his run-ins with certain individuals. At one point, the effectiveness or non-effectiveness of Daniel Herschel was on full display. At one point, he would do really fucked up things to citizens. At one point in May of 2017, a woman called Lillian Parker was selling raffle tickets on the sidewalk. Daniel Herschel started to make a big problem with it. He would arrest her for, quote, selling drugs. She would do 2 days in jail and ultimately sue the Baltimore Police Department for $100,000, and she would be paid out. He was very violent, and he would hassle everybody. At one point, the city had paid out about $250,000 in settlements due to Daniel Herschel's behavior. And just recently, a rapper in Baltimore called Young Moose was recently someone that won a lawsuit against Daniel Herschel. Baltimore Spending Board would approve in May of 2022 a $300,000 settlement in which lawyers from the city would kind of reach with Mr. Moose. Moose, who's born Kayvon Evans, filed a lawsuit in 2021 and originally sought $1.5 million. He would accuse Daniel Herschel of planting drugs on him, illegally arresting him, applying for false warrants that were based on false allegations. Now, Young Moose would actually talk about in interviews that Daniel Herschel had a vendetta against him. At one point, he complained that Herschel was trying to derail his music career before filing a lawsuit. Once police used lyrics and images from one of his videos in a statement of probable cause as they took him into custody, as he took the stage at the Royal Farms Arena for a concert. He was also arrested back in 2012 at a bar. Several police officers handcuffed Young Moose and took him to Daniel Herschel, who was waiting in another location. Herschel opened the trunk of the car, got something out, searched him, and despite fellow officers saying they had already searched Evans, they said he had found crack cocaine on Evans, according to the suit. So this is something that not only did he lose money from, but this was a harassment suit. At one point, Herschel would even arrest the mother of Young Moose. This is the kind of cop that Daniel Herschel was. Now, the question we have is, why was he placed in this department? Due to his behavior. Didn't matter. They were all bringing in cases. Now, you're probably asking, how does this go undetected for so long? In a police department with over 6,000 sworn officers, it's hard to keep track of all of these situations. But again, there was literally no oversight. Now, the only reason there was no oversight is because in the end, we keep going back to the same old thing. These officers were bringing in cases. Now, I want to talk about how things kind of start coming into fruition for figuring out what these guys are up to. And this goes all the way back to a very random situation back in the fall and winter of 2011. We have to go down to Harford County, which is a suburb county of Baltimore. And we find a man called Kenneth Diggins. In December of 2011, and in the fall and winter of that year, Diggins was a heroin junkie. And he had been in and out of rehab. He had met people in rehab. At one point, he meets a woman Jamie. Now, Jamie is from New Jersey. She had come down to Harford County to go to rehab, and they meet in a recovery in Bel Air. At one point, Diggins, who's a bit older than her, they become friends of some sort. In late December, Jamie would text Diggins, whom she had met through a friend at rehab. She wrote, "Do you have any heroin?" Diggins replied, "I got a little something to help you out." Now, by this point, two officers, one from Baltimore County and one from Harford County, are looking into a string of overdoses. By this point, fentanyl was a major problem. The drugs were becoming very pure in these counties that surrounded Baltimore. So two officers, one Scott Kilpatrick from Baltimore County, a detective, and a guy called David McDougall from Harford County, they're looking into these overdoses. Kenneth Diggins, at one point in December of that year, would contact Jamie. And he would say that things are drying up, but he would do what he could to figure something out. He would contact an individual called Twan Washington, a guy that he had regularly bought drugs off of, and asked him if he could get some drugs. He would then contact Jamie, repeatedly offering her drugs. Now, I think at certain points, she decided, you know what? I'm not going to do this. I don't want to relapse. I don't want to do it. He would offer drugs, saying in a text, quote, "I'm trying to have a good time tonight. If you want to join in on the Christmas party, it's on me. I got you covered." Now, Jamie, according to We Own the City by Justin Fenton, would mostly ignore him. "If you're trying to be good, I'm sorry, but no BS. It's definitely top shelf," Diggins would say. Eventually, on December 28th, 2011, Jamie would give in to Diggins' request. She would go over to his house. They would watch TV, use heroin, and have sex. Now, it was consensual. Everything was good. At one point, they finish what they were doing, start watching TV, cuddling, doing the Netflix and chill thing. Jamie dozes off, like most do after doing what they do. The problem was she wouldn't wake up. At that point, Diggins repeatedly is interviewed for hours that day by police. He would instantly lie about the circumstances surrounding Jamie's death before coming clean and naming Antoine Washington as his supplier. Now, this would be the big part of this entire show. Okay, Twan Washington was a drug dealer from Baltimore City, and he had worked in an area of Baltimore called the Alameda. The Alameda was a shopping center up in Woodburn Heights, in an area of Baltimore, not far from the Baltimore County line. And these two detectives, one from Harford and one from Baltimore County, start looking into where these drugs came from, and they were patterned back to Twan Washington. Now, Twan Washington worked directly for a man called Antonio Brill Shropshire. Shropshire had been in the game for a long time. Okay, he had been doing things forever. And he was the guy that was running things. And they would talk about kind of the open air drug market that it was. Shropshire was doing whatever he wanted. And he had turned himself into, kind of a petty drug dealer to some big time kingpin, basically. He had a comfortable lifestyle, traveled from country to country, vacationed in the Caribbean islands, frequently visited casinos, and he had a favorite Ruth Chris steakhouse, claiming that Sacramento, California had the best Ruth Chris. "I love Ruth Chris," he said. Then he was shot a third time in 2014. So while doing what he had to do, he also had to deal with the many problems that being a drug dealer was. So these officers start looking into this, but they also start to wonder how come they're doing all the surveillance and buys in Alameda. And they're noticing that no Baltimore City cops are anywhere near this. In fact, Kilpatrick and McDougal would talk about they were amazed at the brazenness of the drug dealing in this part of the city. Kilpatrick would say these guys would be dealing all day long in the Alameda. Nobody would say a word. "We would do control buys. There were absolutely no patrol cars in sight. We'd take pictures and they didn't even care that we were there." And this is where things start to go weird, okay? They would find a connection between this kingpin, Shropshire, and a man called G Money. He would have regular conversations with a person called G Money. Now, eventually, investigators from the DEA and from these units that were running this surveillance would uncover that G Money was none other than Detective Mamadou Gando, an individual that was part of the Gun Trace Task Force. And they would uncover that Shropshire and Gando had knew each other from when they were kids. Gando was originally from Sierra Leone, a country in Africa, and he had come over to Baltimore in his childhood. He would eventually become a cop, but he would not do away with his long-standing friendship with Shropshire. And the problem that Gando had was not only was he protecting Shropshire's operation, but he was regularly operating as a drug dealer as well. And I want to talk about kind of how this all goes down. And this is how it happens. DEA and FBI start looking into this unit, and then they start doing surveillance and start uncovering all this stuff that's going on. But in March of 2016, this is where things get kind of crazy. Shropshire would call Gando. Shropshire would greet Gando as, "What's up, brother?" Shropshire would respond, "I have a question for you." Gando, quote, "I'm listening." Shropshire, "I took the car to the shop and there's this thing. This thing was lit," referring to the fact that a GPS tracking device had been discovered by Shropshire on his vehicle when he took his vehicle to the repair shop. Now, investigators, the DA, had previously installed this device without his knowledge, obviously to tail and see what he's got going on. Shropshire then asked Gando, "What do I do with it?" Gando asked, quote, "How late is the shop open?" And then said, "I'm trying to see. Run that by me one more time." Shropshire responded, you know what I'm talking about?" And then Gando randomly just says, "Yeah. And is this an iPhone? If you're using an iPhone, FaceTime me." Now, this would enable them to talk without being intercepted. So Gando immediately figures out that someone's on to him. And you would think at that point, okay, maybe I shouldn't do what I'm doing anymore. Now, interestingly enough, at about 20 minutes later, Detective Gando would place an outgoing call to Shropshire in which he would direct Shropshire to get rid of the GPS tracking device. During the call, Gando said, quote, "Basically, when that something like that happens, yo, is basically, you know what I mean, on the other side, law enforcement. You know, it's just a loss. You feel me?" Gando continued, "But definitely somebody's been tracking you. So I'm going to pop it on somebody else's car," said Shropshire. So at that point, you would think, okay, maybe we should be mindful and stop doing what we're doing. Didn't matter. They still continued to do their dirty work. I want to talk about one other quite disgusting situation. And I want to go back to Wayne Jenkins. We're going to ultimately talk about how all these guys were hemmed up, but I just want to continue to talk about some of the completely overt attacks that were going on in Baltimore. At one point in around 2014, Wayne Jenkins is alongside Detective Ben Freeman. They had fought an African-American male driving a nice car through Baltimore. When the man stopped his car and started to run away, Jenkins would drive after him and onto someone's front yard where he would strike 31-year-old Demetric Simon. Now, Simon did say he had drugs on him and knew someone was following, but he was scared. He thought Jenkins and Freeman may have been impersonating police, which again, Wayne Jenkins did not identify himself as police. Jenkins would later in official paperwork say that Simon had pointed a weapon at his partner, and that's when he had ran down Simon to stop the threat. Now, this actually gets bad for Wayne Jenkins because this is another indication of him going after people that he has no legitimate reason to go after, and he has to cover his tracks due to his behavior. On that evening in 2014, Wayne Jenkins realizes, oh shit, I didn't identify myself as police. And now I've hit a person, likely hurt him and injured him. And I need to figure something out here. Now, one of the things that the GTTF would also do is they would plant weapons on people. They would have handguns, BB guns in their car, and they'd plant them on suspects to make it have cause to do what they did. On that evening, Jenkins, who was on duty, called a mentor of his called Keith Gladstone, who was having dinner with another officer in Southeast Baltimore. Now, Gladstone was a part of a higher up unit in the Western District at this point, and he had at one point been kind of the mentor to Wayne Jenkins. Jenkins would call Gladstone and ask him that he needed help and that he had deliberately run over an arrestee in a home in Northeast Baltimore. Gladstone went back inside the restaurant and asked another officer if he had a BB gun. The other officer would say he did not have one. He would then ask to call a partner. He didn't have one. Officer one told Gladstone that officer two did not have a BB gun. Gladstone then left the restaurant, went to the trunk of his BPD vehicle, and retrieved a BB gun. He would then, on a high rate of speed, drive to the area of Antana Avenue and Bel Air Road, where Wayne Jenkins was. Once there, Mr. Gladstone exited his vehicle and carried a BB gun to the front yard of the house where Simon had been run over. Gladstone dropped the BB gun near a pickup truck where Simon lay injured on the ground, unable to move because he was hit by an officer. Gladstone then walks over to Wayne Jenkins in another officer's presence, says, quote, "It's over by the truck," or words to that effect. Gladstone then left the scene and drove away. At that point, another officer recognizes that there's a gun and they wait for crime lab to get there. So again, planting stuff on citizens to fucking destroy them. This is the kind of scumbag shit that these guys were doing. It was actually downright pathetic. It was complete abuse of power. It was completely disgraceful. The last kind of overt act that I want to talk about is probably the most disgusting of these things. Now, again, these are guys that ran in people's houses. These are guys that, you know, at one point, Daniel Herschel stole $500 off a guy just trying to pay his bills. You know, regular citizens. But I want to talk about the Freddie Gray riots, because by this point, Wayne Jenkins in 2015, the spring of 2015, is the big guy. He's the officer in charge. And obviously in April of that year, Freddie Gray is killed in police custody. And obviously this set off a huge chain of events. Riots would ensue. You would have looters looting everything they get their hands on. At one point, Jenkins would actually act as a good cop. He would save the officers from people throwing bricks and stones at them, and he would, you know, help officers that day. But that night, he got a better idea. He realized that night, he could jam guys up that were stealing drugs out of looted pharmacies. At one point, he would actually steal two bags of narcotics with a prescription painkillers and opiates from a CVS. He would then take the drugs to Donald Stepp to sell. Also, in another situation, in and about the same time, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins and officers Taylor and Maurice Ward were acting in capacity as police officers when they would actually interrupt the sale of a large amount of marijuana, about 25 pounds of marijuana in an apartment complex called Belvedere Towers. Jenkins would approach the suspects and say basically that he was a federal agent, and that, hey, look, if you guys just, you know, look away, we'll let you go and we'll just exercise our discretion to charge you in the future if we find you're doing it again. Now, the individuals that were doing this crime were charging approximately $1,000 per pound. So in one bag was about 25K and another bag was 25 pounds. So it was all profit for Jenkins. At that point, Wayne Jenkins would take both bags and then direct officers Taylor and Ward to a wooded area near the intersection of Northern Parkway and Liberty Road. Jenkins would tell both officers to leave their phones in the car in order to avoid detection from law enforcement. So again, there's your conspiracy, your racketeering conspiracy, and to follow them into the woods. Once out of sight, Jenkins then opened the bag of money and gave Taylor and Ward approximately $5,000 each. Now, remember, there's about $25,000 in the bag. So he gives off $10,000, keeps $15,000. They decide, all right, the night's still young. Let's go to a strip club in Baltimore County. At the strip club, Ward and Taylor would testify that, quote, Wayne Jenkins would rob a stripper at that point. They then flee the nightclub after robbing the stripper. So these are the kind of disgusting acts these guys are a part of. Now, ultimately, through a ton of surveillance, a ton of high-profile detective work by the FBI and local law enforcement, the stuff has to start dropping. Before we get to that, though, I just want to quickly discuss at one point, a situation involving Mamadou Gando. During a phone call that was intercepted on May 7, 2016, at approximately 4:18 a.m., an unknown female, quoted as NF, would ask Mamadou Gando, "Where did you go today?" Gando, quote, told her, "I sell drugs. That's what I did today." NF said, "No, you didn't. Where'd you go tonight?" Gando responded, "I'm telling you what I did. I don't want to lie to you. Why would I lie to you for?" Female would ask, "Why would you sell drugs?" Gando answered, quote, "You already know what it is." She would respond, no. Gando would respond, "Yes, I see you at the crib." She would ask, "Why do you sell drugs?" And he would mention that he went out to a nightclub and had several $1,000s on him and had approximately $10,000 on his person that night when he returned home from the nightclub. So that kind of describes the brazenness and arrogance of these people. So in the end, what do we have that has been done here by these eight police officers? We have a lot of crimes. We have extortion. We have drug trafficking. We have abuse of power. We have the abuse of going in people's homes without warrants. We have stealing money. We have hundreds and hundreds of cases that have been tainted. All of this in the end leads to a racketeering conspiracy. And what the feds do is exactly that. In March of 2017, all eight officers are told to report to the internal affairs office of the Baltimore Police Department. At that point, all eight officers are taken into custody and arrested. In the end, through everything that happened, this would cost Baltimore City almost $4.5 million. Now, for all eight officers involved, they would all take different ends in all of this. There is one thing we have to point out, though. In the end, all eight officers spent at least 7 years in prison. And I want to get into each officer and what ultimately happened in their case. Six of them would actually plead guilty. And I want to start with them. Sergeant Thomas Allers, the original sergeant of the crew, would plead guilty in December of 2017. He would get 15 years in federal prison, and he would plead guilty to racketeering conspiracy. To this day, he is in prison at FCI Coleman in Florida. His release date is June 11th, 2030. Mamadou Gando would plead guilty to one count of racketeering conspiracy and one count of conspiracy to distribute and possess with intent to deliver 100 grams or more of a substance containing heroin. He would plead guilty and get 10 years in federal prison. He currently is incarcerated at FCI Butner in North Carolina. His release date is September 7th, 2025. Avodio Hendricks would also plead guilty to racketeering conspiracy, aiding and abetting, and other crimes. In 2018, he was sentenced to 7 years in federal prison, and he was actually released in February of 2022. He would get the lowest sentence of all of these individuals. Also, Maurice Ward, he would plead guilty to racketeering conspiracy. And many people would actually call Ward the one individual out of this group that actually, for the most part, didn't take as much as the others. He would plead guilty and also get 7 years. He was released in February of 2022. So two officers are currently out of prison. The other two involved officers that pled guilty, Jamel Rayum, an individual that had been in this conspiracy for a long period of time. He would be sentenced to 12 years in prison in 2019. He currently sits at the Federal Medical Center in Rochester, Minnesota. He's scheduled for release May 22nd, 2027. The final officer to plead guilty in this case, the ringleader, Wayne Jenkins. Jenkins in 2018 would plead guilty to one count of racketeering, two counts of robbery, one count of destruction, alteration or falsification of records in a federal investigation, and four counts of deprivation of rights under color of law. In June of 2018, he was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison. The former golden boy of the Golden Baltimore Police Department currently sits at the Federal Correctional Institute at Ashland in Kentucky. He is eligible for release July 16th, 2038. He will be 57 years old when he gets out. Subsequently, Wayne Jenkins has done one interview since this indictment and since this sentence. He did an interview with BBC, and he would directly call a reporter. He, for the most part, would not take responsibility for his crimes, now some of which he did, but he would tell the reporter that most of the testimony that Rat Donald Stepp would talk about in selling drugs was false. And in fact, he only sold about $60,000 worth of drugs when Stepp said it was in the millions. Now, Donald Stepp would actually become an informant for the FBI and was actually released and is no longer in prison. I will say, guys, I'm working on interviewing Donald Stepp. I think it would be fascinating, and I hope to have that in the subsequent weeks. Now, two other officers would actually fight this case. Detective Marcus Taylor was filed with charges in 2017. The superseding indictment will come out in June of 2017. Marcus Taylor would be found guilty on two counts of racketeering, aiding and abetting, racketeering and robbery. He would file an appeal in 2018. He was sentenced in 2018 to 18 years in federal prison. Marcus Roosevelt Taylor currently sits at the Federal Correctional Institute at Forest City in Arkansas. He is eligible for release July 2nd, 2032. The final officer in the Baltimore Police Department to be involved in this case, who would be found guilty in 2018, was Detective Daniel Herschel, the man who would hassle citizens, the man who had hassled rioters, the man that had hassled people his entire career. And when I say hassled rioters, I meant to say more protesters, not rioters. He would be found guilty on two counts of racketeering conspiracy, racketeering, aiding and abetting, and robbery on February 12, 2018. In June of that year, he was sentenced also to 18 years in federal prison. Daniel Herschel currently sits at the Federal Medical Center for Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. He would be released on July 2nd, 2032. In multiple interviews, his brother would talk about the fact that to this day, he would say that Daniel Herschel did not do any of the crimes that have been waged against him and he has been found guilty of in a court of law. I did want to end this with a very sad connection to this story, and many people are aware of this situation. If we go way back, guys, to the original really bad situation that Wayne Jenkins was in, remember I told you about that individual that hit the old man in the car and one of the officers had to go check a car out and he found drugs. That individual, Sean Souter, he would ultimately leave the Gun Trace Task Force and he would ultimately become a very decorated homicide detective. In basically 6 months after the indictment on the GTTF officers, Mr. Souter would be called upon to testify in front of a grand jury. As we know, when the feds arrest someone, they involve everyone that may have been involved in the indictment, so anyone that may have played a part. And at one point, it was questioned as to whether Souter was a dirty cop, because at one point, he had worked directly with Wayne Jenkins. The feds get him to agree to testify in court. The day before he was asked to testify, he, alongside another officer, a partner of his called Bomenka, were actually dispatched and went to the Harlem Park neighborhood of Baltimore, West Baltimore. They're investigating a death. In the afternoon of that day, a call came over the dispatch that an officer was hit, and there was an officer down in the area of Harlem Park. That day, in a wooded lot, Sean Souter was found shot to death multiple times. And there have been documentaries about this case. There have been all sorts of news pieces about this case. Sean Souter would die that day in the line of duty. And his end of watch was in November of 2017. Now, there have been a lot of questions. In fact, a review board was actually brought in independent of the Baltimore Police Department to review this case. Now, the feds would say they were not going to review it. The IRB would take a look at this case and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that to them, Sean Souter's death, in their opinion, was a suicide. Now, if you've ever seen the video, there is a shrinking video of a poll camera that shows Mr. Souter behind a car near the wooded lot where you can see him toying with something. At one point, he yells police and runs into the lot, supposedly fires off two shots, and then the shot to his head. Now, many people, including the creator of The Wire and We Own the City, David Simon, would dispel that they believe that Mr. Souter took his own life. Now, again, I'm not a cop, nor am I a detective or involved in any law enforcement, but it is a wonder if Sean Souter actually did. We have to ask ourselves, why on earth, if someone was going to shoot a cop, would they, A, get into a scuffle with the police officer? Because remember, Sean Souter, his death came from his service weapon. What person would fight a cop over his gun just to shoot him with the gun? Let's say you don't win that altercation. That cop is going to shoot you dead. Also, if we know anything, his radio is in his hand still, as well as the hand that he was he used on a regular basis is the same side that his head was shot. So there's a lot of things here. And I urge you, there's certain documentaries out there that detail Sean Souter's death. Now, a lot of people, again, were skeptical to believe this due to the fact that, as we know, the Baltimore Police Department is very corrupt. And it's hard to believe. But in the end, I do believe Sean Souter did take his own life. This is just a very sad connection to this, because, again, he was supposed to testify a day after. Now, Daniel Herschel would actually write a letter to that review board and say that he knew about the death of Sean Souter. And I've also talked to certain people that say that the shoe has not completely dropped on certain members of the GTTF. I guess we'll have to wait and see, and what other people shed as far as light is concerned. Look, in the end, Keith Davis, the former police commissioner for Baltimore City, would say it best. These officers were 1930 style gangsters. In the end, they are no different than the individuals we talk about, ones that are from the Lucchese crime family, Bonanno crime family, the Detroit crime family. It really doesn't matter. These officers used their power and prestige to wage a war on citizens, to extort and steal from citizens, and in the end, are some of the most dirty cops we'll ever see in America. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I surely enjoyed bringing it to you. Make sure you let me know what you think about it, and go check us out on Twitter at SitDown7. Tell your friends about the show. If you think you know someone that might enjoy it, please tell them. Next week, we'll get back to some mafia content. I think we're going to talk about the very interesting Tommy Lucchese next week. We'll have to wait and see. As always, though, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.